The views and content expressed on the following program are provided solely for informational and entertainment purposes. They do not constitute legal advice. A podcast is not a substitute for retaining a competent, licensed attorney to advise you on your specific legal situation. How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the show. It is time for Break the Business, where we empower indie creators and have some fun along the way. I'm Ryan Carella, and it is a pleasure to have you here this week. We got ourselves an unbelievable show. I can hardly contain my excitement for the fantastic topics that we have waiting for us this week. Great conversations, lots of hijinks. It's going to be a terrific hour, and we're so glad to have you here with us for it. Our guest coming up in the next segment, exciting guest we got, Brad Mindich. He is the CEO of Definitive Authentic. He's a music merchandiser and archivist. He specializes in direct-to-archival sales of some of music's biggest stars. He's dedicated his career to preserving and protecting the legacies of some of your most favorite artists and athletes and entertainers. I'm pretty excited for this guest, and I know our co-host is as well. I know he loves this kind of stuff. He loves merchandise. He certainly loves the legacy artists, and so there's going to be a lot of great conversation to be had with the co-host and the guest. Let's bring out our co-host this week, musician, investor, frontman for Gideon King and City Blog, Gideon King, joining us. Hi, Gideon.
Howdy. Long time no speak. See.
It has been entirely too long. We missed you last month. That is to say, I missed you last month because your week was the week that I had surgery, and so we didn't get to hang out. And I got some Gideon King withdrawal. There's so many things going on right now in the industry that are very business heavy, that are very Wall Street investor, venture capital heavy. And you're the guy I got to talk to about these things. And so, I mean, there's been so many times where, like, we've just been exchanging emails or texts because we haven't had the opportunity to have a show to talk about these things. So, needless to say, I'm glad you're here, my friend.
Thanks, man. Let's talk. Let's have a powwow. Does anybody say powwow anymore?
You've already been canceled for that. We just got the email from one of those anti-defamation leagues. You're in a world of trouble.
Yeah, I got you.
The same people that that changed the name of the baseball team in Cleveland have already just destroyed you professionally for that.
That's cool. I wasn't that well. Listen, I wasn't that famous to begin with, so the fall from grace is not very deep.
It was more of just like a you know, 6-inch drop from grace.
Yeah. But, exactly.
Either way, well, glad that you fell right here to us. Like the setup this week, I think, I know in past weeks you've been trying to get your audio setup just the way you like it. You're something of a perfectionist when it comes to your audio and video setup, as many musicians are. I feel like we've hit a good spot. You sound great this week. You look great. Love the setup behind you. Love the boom mic on your mic. That looks cool.
I don't know why it's all working better. I have no skill at technology. So to the extent that there's improvement, it's like a random event.
Well, that is the tale of audio engineering, isn't it? Isn't
yeah, it? Is.
My audio totally. Doesn't work. I don't know why. My audio works. I don't know why.
Exactly, dude. It's random, man.
Now, in this same vein, Gideon, of stories happening involving business and investing in music, there is one story in particular that, you know, streaked across my sky. A few different listeners and friends of the show sent me this story, and I was just so glad that you were up as the co-host this week to talk about it. Want to get your perspective as an investor, somebody who's worked in this industry for a long time, about a recent article in the New York Times that came out. I guess, to be fair, we should call it an essay, because it certainly wasn't a impartial article, right? The article did have a slant to it, but it was an essay in the New York Times this week, talking about the implications of private equity firms continuing this trend of buying up music companies, buying up music copyrights and publishing rights away from artists, and perhaps some of the dangers of this emerging trend. I'm going to go ahead and read right from the article here because I think the article does a pretty good job of laying things out right from the beginning. Quote, "Does this song on your phone or on the radio or in the movie theater sound familiar? private equity, the industry responsible for bankrupting companies, slashing jobs, and raising the mortality rates at the nursing homes it acquires, is making money by gobbling up the rights to old hits and pumping them back into our present. So far, I think it's pretty fair and balanced. I'm not seeing a slant in this article yet.
Not yet.
The result is markedly blander music scene as financiers cannibalize the past at the expense of the future and make it even harder for us to build those new artists whose contributions will enrich our entire culture. In particular, Gideon, the article talks about how Primary Wave, which is a music publishing company backed by two private equity firms, bought the rights to Whitney Houston's catalog, and which led to the spearheading of Whitney Houston movie, a Whitney Houston NFT, a Whitney Houston fragrance, all in the efforts to boost streams of these of this old music. Continuing from the article, quote, buying up rights to a proven hit, dusting it off, and dressing it up as a movie may impress at a shareholder conference, but it does little to add to a sustainable and vibrant music ecosystem. And God, this quote right here, this is powerful. Like farmers struggling to make it through the winter, to think of another industry upended by private equity, we are eating our artistic seed corn. I know you've worked heavily in the private equity space. You've done, you know, you've worked in a lot of different industries. I think you might have a more forgiving attitude towards private equity than I think is the conventional wisdom these days. Love to get your perspective on this. Do you see the rising trend of private equity in music, this increased securitization of copyrights, a good thing? Do you think the dangers are overblown?
So that article was more about vitriol, anger, and substanceless utterances than it was about
that was pretty balanced. I don't know what
about,
you're talking about
facts and balanced viewpoints. Here's the thing. Forget Whitney Houston and forget Adele and forget these huge names. Here's what actually happens when private equity buys a catalog. Okay? There's an artist, and that artist may have a net worth of $50,000. That artist may have a net worth of $500,000 if he or she is lucky. And if they're really lucky, they'll have a net worth north of $1 million. But in any event, most of them who monetize are 40, 38. They have a wife, they have a kid, okay? And they have this asset. And instead of cash dribbling in over time for this asset, what actually happens is they come and say, hey, Ryan, you know, you got to pay for your kid's education and you're too old to tour every night, okay, because it's too taxing on your body and too taxing on your family. How about we pay you the present value plus a discount of the future cash flows of your catalog? Put differently, and unless Wall Street speak, how about we front you a bunch of money and we have to make a rate of return too, generally between 8 and 16%, not much better than that. And so what's actually happening in the real world, away from the hyperbole and the silliness of this, I don't know what I want to call it, verbal diarrhea of an article. what's actually happening is that private equity is getting liquidity to a lot of artists who really need it. And often in these deals, the artist is still keeping a piece of the revenues. And what private equity is doing is bringing more resources, more organized resources to bear, frankly, better than distribution agents and useless record labels, and consolidating the monetization process of those assets. So now, does private equity overpay sometimes? You're damn right, which is why, by the way, this article is already old news, meaning they're already actually the capital flows into this space are actually declining now. I look at these deals all the time. Does private equity overpay sometimes? Yeah. Do they underpay and it's not as good a deal for the artist? Sure. But rather than demonize a group that's providing liquidity to artists in a way that they could never get, because traditional banks won't lend against those catalogs because they're neither sophisticated nor enterprising enough to do so. They're actually, I don't want to say, it's not an act of altruism, okay? But it's not an immoral act. It's an amoral act driven by commerce. Just the way when a frozen shrimp company wants to get some cash in the door so it can make more frozen shrimp, it has a factoring arrangement from a bank who comes in and fronts a bunch of money against their receivables, against the future flows of their business. You know, there's a million examples. So all you're really seeing away from the hyperbole of this article is a simple, repeatable, very common arrangement in music that we see everywhere else, which is factoring. You are factoring the future payments of an artist. And actually, most managers and artists are wildly thrilled to do these deals. Frankly, my manager just did it with some of his artists. I will keep it nameless. Absolutely thrilled. I frankly think the private equity firm overpaid. Okay. And so the rates of return are not predatory. They're sort of just above stock market rates of return for the risk, for the private equity shops. And as for the notion that it's causing, it is moving the industry towards less incentive to create, I actually don't see that, nor do I get it. So like, in the real world, away from the Whitney Houston catalog, okay, private equity is sort of performing not an immoral function, but just sort of an amoral function driven by rates of returns and what an artist needs. But trust me when I tell you, Ryan, as a guy who is a staunch defender of artist rights and the plight of artists, which you are, okay, I can tell you I know a trillion artists who do this. They are thrilled with these arrangements, and they feel that finally the value of what they've put together in a catalog has been monetized. And further, and one more thing, and I don't want to speak for too long, so forgive me. It's actually an incentive for artists to create a complete and robust and diverse catalog so that ultimately private equity sees those diverse and robust assets and will pay some kind of a premium for it. So this guy who wrote this article, or woman, it was hard for me to even finish because it was so silly, so I couldn't tell who wrote it. That person who wrote it doesn't actually know what the hell they're talking about. Now,
I would say, given the level of vitriol in this article and some of the rather delightful turns of phrase, especially that piece about seed corn at the end. Frankly, I wish I wrote this, and I might have, perhaps, if I, you know, I might have gotten like super drunk one night and decided to go on a screed about private equity, and the New York Times published it. Look, I am with you on the notion that private equity's involvement in music can be a win for certain legacy artists who can cash out their catalogs to the tune of sometimes up to nine figures if they're one of these big time artists. And why not get that money today rather than have it trickle out over generations long after the artist is dead? I can completely understand that. What you're not going to be able to convince me on is that private equity's involvement in the music industry is a win for the industry as a whole. I think there is something to be said that private equity, when they come in, they buy these catalogs, they're incentivized to squeeze every drop they can out of the catalogs they bought at the expense of investing in new music, in good music. And I don't think it's that they're immoral. I think it is baked into the bread of how private equity, particularly the private equity that specializes in leverage buyouts, how they work. These are not investment models that by their nature are investing to innovate in what's next. They are built to, you know, basically cash out existing assets, especially like companies that special or investment firms that specialize in leverage buyouts. They don't buy companies to try to, you know, get them to new eras of innovation. It's often let's buy them, let's leverage the crap out of them, extract whatever value we can until the company is a husk that has too much interest payments to stay profitable. But meanwhile, we've extracted all the value out of the company. That kind of model is not what the music industry needs to stay innovative.
Actually, it's just the opposite, man. For one, these assets are not bought with significant leverage. So analogizing them to, you know, when Macy's was bought in a private equity or Toys R Us or some of these well-known disasters. And by the way, that's what you see in the public. Most private equity deals work out, actually, and create jobs. They don't lose it. But let's not get into a sort of an abstract argument about private equity. A, these assets are not bought with a lot of leverage. B, There's a ton of innovation. What actually happens is the private equity firm looks at this group of assets in a way that no representative of the artist would look at and monetizes them. You're right, squeezes as much value out of them, make sure that those assets are in front of the right music supervisors, that if they're playing, okay, at Walmart while someone's going and buying pencils, that the artist gets paid. Make sure that if they're playing in Malaysia somewhere, the artist gets paid. So I actually, this is one of the rare times where, as much as I love you deeply, as much as I love you, the extent to which I love you is the extent to which I disagree with you. How's that for a diplomatic? Come on, dude. Give me some credit at least for that one.
The extent to which I love you is equal to the extent to which I disagree with you.
Yeah, because
you sound like my wife.
Sorry. Well, you know, she and I talk. Trust me. But that's not true for you listeners. I mean, that is not true.
You're talking about like all of the extracting of value out of these copyrights by private equity as a good thing. Like, you know, society needs more Whitney Houston NFTs and Whitney Houston fragrances. Like, we don't need all of these. We don't need every single derivative from I Want to Dance with Somebody. What we need is the next Whitney Houston. We need the next artist. We need a place for new artists to create, not just lean on the old catalogs.
But that's the problem with the argument that we're having. You said before something super interesting. You said this money going towards these copyrights and the like at the expense of spending money on new artists and new creation. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that the capital flows towards these assets would otherwise be directed towards artist development. That's actually a different space. Okay. Now, if private equity starts buying a bunch of labels and buys the big labels and the big sub labels, well, that's a different question then, okay?
I mean, that's inevitable, right?
But my private equity buddies who I know who are buying these assets, okay, they're not otherwise investing in artists, nor are they. What they're actually helping artists do is monetize what they have in ways they never thought possible. So, and again, I would like to direct us away from the quote unquote exemplar in this discussion of Whitney Houston, because dude, that's not an exemplification. That is not the typical thing that's happening. That's like Whitney Houston catalog is like, it's like the song Can't Buy Me Love. Like, dude, that's an asset for all ages. For the most part, the working musician, and I don't even like the word legacy musician. Actually, what really happens is the guy I know just sold his catalog. What he said is, now I can do my next album because I have the money. Okay. So I am not acting as if private equity is coming in this magnanimous altruistic act to help poor starving artists. That's for damn sure what they're not doing. That's not in their nature. But I can tell you that whether it's serendipitous or not, I actually think this is a super positive development for the industry and getting artists paid for catalog if they've put the work in to write lots of songs and to develop a big catalog. So if you want to kick me off the show now, I'm happy to leave right now. Just let me know, because the Knick game's on. So just let me know.
Oh my God. And the Knicks are playing really well lately.
They're doing a little better. Yeah.
I mean, always a shock when I actually look at the score.
It's one of the worst franchises in basketball history. But of course, that's enough. You know, what we need is private equity to buy the Knicks.
Yeah, private equity needs to come in. No, because then if private equity bought the Knicks, they would just sell a bunch of Willis Reed merchandise and stop scouting new players.
Man, you're dark tonight. Usually I'm the one who's dark. You're dark tonight,
Can I tell you what my other concern is with this trend? Because looking at it through a legal perspective.
Yeah.
You know, we've decried on this show a lot the rise of copyright litigation, seeing more and more lawsuits about, artists saying that some song from today ripped off of some Marvin Gaye song for 30 years ago, even though the artist had never really heard that Marvin Gaye song. Maybe it was in the back of their head or something while they were writing the song, but they didn't mean to steal the song. And for the most part, most of those potential lawsuits never saw the light of day in the old days, because the artist who owned the copyright was just like, yeah, that kind of sounds like my song, but I don't really care. And, I'm not going to sue another artist. You know who does sue artists? Private equity firms hedge funds, if those people own the copyrights, they are bound with a fiduciary duty to maximize their revenue. No. And so more and more we're seeing copyright plaintiffs being not the artist who owns a copyright, but hedge funds, but investment vehicles that own the copyrights. You're going to see a lot more of these kind of lawsuits if we have more securitized copyright ownership.
I'm not sure about that. These are very commercial entities, and they're not going to litigate and have that show up as a line item on their expenses, which the investors bear, unless that is a very meritorious piece of litigation. They're not in the business of getting involved in frivolous litigation because it costs money, makes them look stupid. So again, I'm going to say to you that it actually may make some defendants straighten up and fly right in ways that they never were before, unless you're telling me, which I'm not sure I would believe, that the lawsuits that you've seen thus far are without merit and where they're not at least very colorable claims.
I mean, but in the world of copyright law, you can't just draw the line between with and without merit, right? Copyright juries are the most unstable force in the universe, and so many of these cases live in the gray. Lauren, if you could, a little bit of research here for me, since we're doing this on the fly. There was an Ed Sheeran copyright case. It wasn't the one with Marvin Gaye, or maybe it might have been. But like, look for an Ed Sheeran copyright case where the plaintiff in that case, like one of the plaintiff's name was like structured asset sales or something like that. I mean, I know I'm not giving you a lot of information to work with, but see if you can find the caption of that case. I think it involved Ed Sheeran, and the name and the litigant was not an artist. It was an investment vehicle that was duty fiduciarily bound to maximizing its revenue, and it did so by suing everything that moved. See if you can find that one for me.
Well, but that may be a patent trolley kind of approach that this one group has. But the people I know buying these types of assets, the last thing on their mind is getting involved in costly litigation, which is anomalous, difficult to predict. That's not the quote unquote visibility that you're looking for investors. I mean, I look at these deals all the time. If these people told me, hey, Gideon, put your money in this deal. Okay. And by the way, one of the things we're going to do is we're going to perfect our rights with a bunch of lawsuits. I would say, dude, I know a lot about IP litigation. Okay. I've bet on it. I've worked on it. And one thing I can tell you is it's hard. It's a hard business. That's not part of the pitch, and it hasn't been part of the action that I've seen. So, but listen,
I mean, it has to be part of the pitch. Your whole model is based on monetizing the copyrights and monetizing your exclusive rights. If anybody gets near your exclusive rights, wouldn't you be bound to your investors to
actually
root that out?
Actually, no. What you want to make sure is that the assets that you buy are free from doubt, and that you can go. And you see, these assets, when private equity guys look at this, they look at it no different than a cell phone tower. They look at it no different than a building in the middle of downtown Miami where they are collecting quote unquote stable rents. All they want is an asset that is not correlated with the stock market, because then they can say we are a differentiated offering. All they're looking for is what they call market non-directional assets. They're not looking to get involved in a bunch of litigation. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure there are certain ones who, as part of their pitch, say we see lots of opportunities in being a freaking patent troll and going suing everybody's ass. That may be true. But for the most part, okay.
I think I saw that in a private placement memorandum once.
Yeah, right. Suing everybody's ass. Maybe. Yeah, that's right. But in the risk section. But you know what? But you know what, man? I can tell you honestly, from the bottom of my heart, I'm looking at one right now, okay, which is one of the biggest. They've sued no one. They don't want to sue anybody. They don't want to even be in the ecosystem in that capacity suing people. They want to buy a staple market non-directional asset, no different than they will buy a building with 97% occupancy with a good net operating income. I think it's the whole discussion of this is far too emotional. Far too. And the funny part of it is, once too many people are doing it, it'll slow down. And the rates of return will get down to like 9%, which is only 1% better than the stock market. And then nobody will do it.
I mean, you almost say like you're wondering why this is an emotional issue. Like private equity, particularly like the ones that traffic in leverage buyouts, have not done themselves any favors. We've seen way too many instances of this model destroying beloved companies, destroying jobs in the name of, you know, what they call, you know, economic progress or something. Like I loved going to Toys R Us as a kid. Some of my most treasured childhood memories are walking the halls of Toys R Us with my parents and, you know, getting to buy a new toy. It sucks for me that when my son grows up, there will be no Toys R Us to take him to because private equity picked that company apart.
Actually, many companies that are pulled out of bankruptcy survive and continue to employ people because of exit financing of private equity. A lot of the biotechnology and medicines we consume today are because of risk capital of private equity. A lot of affordable housing is because of private equity and government subsidies that help them do it, of course. So again, what I'm calling for or asking for is a more balanced view. For every Toys R Us that you can bring up as a citation of the tragedy of private equity's involvement in our life, I can pull up one where you would say, boy, oh boy, private equity was like Mother Teresa in this case. I can't get caught up in these emotional attacks on given industries or whatever. It's like when people say, you know, Ryan, all the lawyers are a bunch of sharks. Actually, I use lawyers all the time, and I know a bunch of them that are really good, really honest people. I also know some complete bags who are lawyers, meaning there's got to be balance in the way that we look at things, or else we join the chorus of people who are imbalanced, and God forbid, that's not what we want to do.
You're absolutely right. This program, more than any
other... Wait a minute.
Other,
he just said I was right. I want this recorded, I want it repeated.
I'm with you on that. This program, above all others, should aspire to that sort of integrity and even-handedness. What we should not be doing is, you know, just picking on particular business models to go for the easy joke and, you know, to certainly not besmirch, you know, the work that you've done so much of in your career, Gideon, and all the great things you've done with private equity.
I'm cool, man.
That would be unacceptable. That being said, I'm about to dedicate the next 5 minutes to doing just that with our AI Overlord tip of the week.
I knew that was going to happen. AI Overlord tip of the week.
Once again, being wildly unfair to producer Lauren by not giving her any heads up that segment was coming, but I didn't think it was coming either. I just thought it was such a naturally good transition to get to. You might be surprised to hear, Gideon, that I've spoken with some folks that are working in the private equity space on the music side, and they, like you, have heard some of the bad comments that have been made lately about private equity and thought that it was being unfair, that it was painting, you know, with a slanted brush, and that they wanted to have the opportunity to set the record straight about the great things that private equity are doing in music. So private equity firms working closely with the AI overlord, ChatGPT, have actually written up a commercial script, you'd be happy to know, talking about all the great things that private equity is doing in the music industry right now.
I feel like I'm being ambushed, but that's cool.
I don't know. Like, I mean, I saw the script. I got an early look at it. I thought it does a really nice job creating a positive message about the great things that private equity is doing in this space. And if you like, I'd like to read the script out here for you that ChatGPT put together. Lauren, do we have some good commercial music for this?
My God.
Oh, nice.
Love it.
Are you tired of the relentless innovation and the unending wave of new music artists making it hard to keep up? Fear not, because private equity is here to simplify your musical landscape. From the people who destroyed Toys R Us, Radio Shack, and every small town medical practice in America, private equity is here to make sure that the music you love never has to innovate or be interesting again. Gone are the days of sifting through new genres, artists, and discovering new music to love. Thanks to your friends at private equity, you can relive yesterday's hits today and tomorrow, and forever until you're dead. Why risk investing your precious time in new, emerging talent when you can bank on the same four chords that have been chart toppers for decades? With private equity, we're not just recycling music, we're ensuring that your musical diet never has to change. Ever. Worried about the future of music? Don't be. We're committed to buying up every song you've ever loved and squeezing every penny out of them, so you don't have to worry about finding a new favorite song ever again. And who needs new artists to enrich our culture when you can just listen to the same playlist from high school until retirement? Not us. Thanks to private equity, the good old days of music are now and forever and nothing else. So let's hear it for private equity, ensuring that music innovation is a thing of the past, because who really needs evolution in art? Join us in celebrating a future where every day is a throwback Thursday. Private equity in music. Because why risk the new when you can profit from the old? Warning, excessive consumption of recycled music may lead to acute nostalgia and chronic creativity deficiency.
Do you feel better now?
I mean, I thought they nailed it. I mean,
do you feel better? I feel like you feel that was like a cathartic. All I can say is I hope you feel better. That's it. Like, I want you to feel good. I'm your co-host. I want you to feel good about yourself.
As I was reading it, I was so afraid to look at your face.
It's cool. I'm fine. You can't hurt my feelings. I'm a callous private equity guy with no soul. So how could you
possibly? That's right. You're amoral.
Exactly. How can you possibly hurt my feelings when I have no feelings?
I do want to give you the last word on this. You were telling me that you were working on a private equity project where you guys like cured a disease or something, right?
I mean, I've worked on public and private equity things where, man, we're funding therapies at great risk to the capital for rare diseases. I mean, right now, I'm a shareholder in something that has a therapy for pulmonary hypertension with interstitial lung disease, and that is something you don't want. And so listen, man, demonize capital all you want, but the very microphone you use and the very antibiotics that you take when you get the sniffles, at some level they come from private equity and private capital. And that's my AI overlord tip of the week.
I'm sure all of that is true, and you know, I will always be a big fan of some of the really cool stuff you do, like in the charity and saving the world space. Like, obviously, you know, you're a bloodthirsty, amoral investor type, but you've also, like, you know, helped people and cured diseases, and I know you legitimately do devote a lot of your resources to charitable efforts, and I think that I'm a big fan of all of that. That being said, I really miss Toys R Us, man. Let's take a quick break, and then we're going to be joined by our guest, Brad Mindich. Really excited for this. Don't go anywhere. Keep checking out Break the Business.
Break the Business is presented in cooperation with Ryan A. Carella, PA. Ryan A. Carella, PA is a law firm providing transactional entertainment legal services, including contracts, business formation, commercial law, copyright, trademark, and more. Ryan A. Carella, PA, Miami, Florida. rkpalaw.com.
Streaming services for Break the Business provided by LEK Entertainment. LEK Entertainment is a full-service entertainment company offering everything from consultations to full-scale events and productions, including audio and video productions, voiceovers, staged theatrical productions, script and music development, and streaming services. For more information, visit lekentertainment.com. LEK Entertainment wants to help you bring your story to life.
Thanks for supporting Break the Business. If you have a question or topic that you want us to discuss, email us at breakthebusiness@gmail.com. You can follow the host, that's me, on Twitter at Ryan KAIR, and you can follow the show at the BTB Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook, and on all major podcast platforms. And now, let's get back to the show. Welcome back to Break the Business, everybody. Ryan Corelli here with Gideon King. Just having an absolute blast. Wherever you're checking us out, whether it's on SiriusXM 145, major podcasting platforms, live streaming platforms like Facebook Live or Twitch or soon to be volume.com, we're doing that next month. That's going to be pretty fun. Wherever you're checking us out, we're so glad that you are. Gideon, I found the case I was thinking of.
Oh, here we go.
So man. 2023, okay? You remember that big lawsuit that Ed Sheeran went through where he had to defend himself because somebody said that his song Thinking Out Loud sounded too much like the song Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye, even though basically the only similarity between the two songs was just that it had a similar chord progression, but none of the lyrics were the same. The melody wasn't really the same. And by any definition, the music industry collectively came together and said, this lawsuit is BS and it's frivolous, and it still made it all the way to a jury. And so you're probably thinking, oh, who are the litigants, right? Clearly it must have been the Gaye estate or Marvin Gaye versus Ed Sheeran. Well, let's go ahead and look at our case citation. The parties are Structured Asset Sales LLC v. Sheeran. I mean, you don't get more like securitized private equity sounding, investment vehicle sounding than that.
Maybe. I'm going to find out who that is. You might be wrong. Most of these large catalogs actually have a group that helps them to structure it, and they do have an LLC named something or other. So I'm gonna fact check you on that.
Well, you should definitely research it, but if I'm wrong, try not to find that information until after the show is over.
I'm not going to do it.
I would hate to be proved wrong on the air.
No way. I would never do that.
Yeah. I definitely wouldn't want you to bring that up because it would be really devastating to my argument. before we bring in our guest, producer Lauren, can you hop in here for a quick second?
Uh-oh, SpaghettiO.
Could you give the viewers and listeners like a little bit of an update about what's going on with volume.com right now? You've been like exchanging more emails with them than I have. I've seen some of the graphics they've put together for when we're going to join the volume.com platform next month. What's the latest with that?
Everything is looking great. They've got a team that's laying our graphics out, not in our simple two or three different looks, but like all the different banners and all the different sizes and making sure that they promote not just us, but all the guests that are coming on the show. And we're really, really looking forward to it. The system that they have set up, I have to look more into what they offer the artists that they work with, but the platform itself has been so impressive and the team behind it and all the people putting stuff together that, I'm excited to see the audience that they bring us because I like the people that they're bringing around them. And so it's a community that I am excited to be a part of. They're really, really wonderful people.
They really are. And the people they have making the graphics and the other assets for us, just, oh my God, chef's kiss. I can't wait to get on this platform so y'all can see the amazing artwork they've put together for us. Because like you all have been, I'll put it mildly, you all have been punished for the 2 years we've been live streaming because most of the graphics have just been like thrown together by me in Microsoft Paint, and you've had to suffer through that. And finally, with volume.com coming in as one of our partners, we got some damn professionals in here making our graphics, and it's going to make us look good. It's going to make so in the weeks where it's me and Gideon and you joining the folks on volume.com, we're going to look our best, and I'm excited for that next month.
Yeah,
they're probably backed by private equity. That's my guess.
God, they probably
I'm
are.
I'm saying there's something wonderful about
if
the.
If they are, I want a public apology, and that's
I'm
all.
Gonna
I'm
going to get
saying.
An email in my inbox from them canceling our contract.
You know it's gonna happen.
You know, and
but they'll give you a show because you were defending the hell out of private equity this last segment.
I was totally on Gideon's side too. Not that I should not kick myself out here, think that any people that are willing to give artists money when they want it isn't necessarily the worst. It's, as long as they're structuring deals where the artist feels like they're not losing their baby, having their baby make the money selling, like he's saying, an album after you've done it to people who want to then use that to market it and make money and things like that. And you got what you wanted for it. that's a good opportunity to me. Closing that door just sounds like one less
Ryan,
way for people to make money that don't get any
Ryan,
money anyway.
This is what I do. Let me tell you something. Here's what I do. This is what private equity does. It comes in and it breaks up families. And this is what I'm doing.
You know?
This is what I'm doing. It's divide and conquer. I have broken up a family on the air. This is better than like any reality TV.
Yeah. Wait, private equity, you've done a leverage buyout to liquidate my own sister from my family. I can't believe, you know, another thing destroyed by private equity. Exactly. Now I don't have a sister or Toys R Us anymore. Get out of here, producer Lauren. Right. Let's go ahead and, I can't believe she made that face. I love you, Lauren. Let's go ahead and bring out our guest this week. Maybe he'll be on my side. He is the CEO of Definitive Authentic. With a name like that, maybe not. He's probably knows a lot of private equity guys. It's an organization that specializes in direct-to-fan archival sales of some of music's biggest stars and that are dedicated to preserving and protecting the legacies of iconic entertainers, athletes, and creators. You can find out more about our guest's work by visiting DefinitiveAuthentic.com. We are happy to welcome Brad Mindich on to Break the Business. Hi, Brad.
Hey, guys. So I'm enjoying listening to the banter back and forth. It's I'm not sponsored by private equity, so I think we're all good there.
I'm going to call him on my side for this, Gideon King.
I knew this would happen.
And I'm not going to ask him a follow-up question because then I'll find out he doesn't agree with me. And I don't need that right now.
I'm sending Brad a PayPal right now to agree with everything I say. I'm buying his opinions off like private equity does.
I'll take it. I'm good. Gideon, we'll hang.
Exactly.
It's a pleasure to be chatting with you, Brad. And I do want to talk to you all about the work that you do. I don't think we've ever had a guest quite like you before. And, you know, a musical archivist in a way, helping to protect and preserve artists' legacies. Really, really interesting. But I would be committing journalistic malpractice if I didn't start the interview with what I think is a pretty dang interesting fact about you. Apparently, Brad, according from what I've read, you got your start in the entertainment industry by handling booking for a nightclub that was run by the mob. But you said that it was cool because like the mobsters were nice to you. I got to hear some of the backstory, like any wild stories about like working in a mob run nightclub.
Yeah. So it is correct. I did. In fact, that was my first job out of college, and yes, they were very nice to me. I also had really long hair and I practiced the guitar for 8 hours a day and I chain smoked and all that. So I didn't really fit the mold for anything other than, you know, booking bands.
I think about that screams wise guy.
Yeah, right. It does not. It does not. But I think the one of those moments where I was kind of like, all right, this is very interesting, is I remember answering the phone. I mean, it was, you know, classic nightclub, right? So anybody answer the phone. So I picked up the phone and the guy said, let me talk to Frank Jr. And I said, sure. Okay. May I ask who's calling? And he said, tell him it's Bugsy. And I said, okay. And I put on hold and I said, Frank, Bugsy's on the phone. He went, put him through. And I was like, this is all real. Like this is God. All real. So that, and the fact that, you know, the receipts didn't always add up at the end of the night, but you just don't ask questions. You just do your job.
I mean, that must have been a big part of what you did, was just like a whole lot of booking artists and looking the other way.
Yep. Keep your mouth shut. You've seen enough films. Keep your mouth shut.
That's right. And now turning to the work that you do, thank you for tolerating that trip down memory lane there. I hope you didn't provide any answers that are going to increase the risk of you getting whacked at any point. To business. Does it mean for a company to work in direct-to-fan archival sales? What do you do for the biggest stars in music and their fans? I've heard your work described as cultural archaeology, which has to be like the coolest subject area I've ever heard. I wish I could have majored in that in college. Can you tell us a little bit about like the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit broader than sort of this kind of, you know, direct sales type of thing. So what we do is really, there are two sides of our business. One is, it's sort of the parent company is Invenium. And what we do there, the way we describe it, is we help our clients connect their past, present, future, which in some cases, in all seriousness, does mean the selling of their catalogs or whatever.
No!
You know, it's just, what's their future, right? And we've seen some of our
clients. Thank you, Brad.
I'm just here to help, Gideon. That's
another check cleared.
Another PayPal is on the way.
But seriously, the what it means when we say connecting the past, present, futures, we do everything as it relates to this idea. So meaning we dig through the homes and the warehouses and office areas and storage facilities and hard drives. We are let in and have access in ways that really nobody else does. And I don't say that in any sort of bravado way. I say it in the fact that we've earned that trust, and our whole business really is completely based on trust. And then from there, we do all the archiving and the preservation and the digitization. And then from there, we authenticate, we capture stories around these artifacts, we curate, and then really help our clients figure out what they want to do. So for some clients, they do want to monetize and they want to sell things directly to fans. And it's all, you know, coming directly from the artist, you know, to the fan, which is very meaningful and drives, you know, a huge amount of value. For other clients, they want to do museums, they want to do pop-up stores, they want to do merch, or they just want things safe and protected because, and you guys both know this, right? Bad things happen when you don't know, you know, where your things are, what you have, what they're worth. And so it's really an entire kind of holistic service and suite of products that we provide for our clients so that we super serve them and their fans.
What is the coolest thing that you've ever found in the course of the work that you're doing? Like just looking through papers and looking through artists' houses. What's the coolest thing that you found that would have otherwise been lost to history?
Oh my goodness. I'll give you specific examples, but I will tell you it happens all the time because typically things are, you know, you know this, you all have attics and basements in your homes. Like, do you know what's in all your boxes? I'm sure you don't, unless you're really, really OCD, you know, which there's nothing wrong with that. But most people, and, you know, certainly on the iconic, you know, creator level, it's years of things that have been put in boxes and storage facilities. They just don't know. So we take all those and we start going through them. And that's where all of these, the sort of magic is really revealed. I'm saying like overly dramatic, but it is sort of the photographs they didn't know they had, or the audio, or what they just didn't know because it was just thrown in boxes. So to give you kind of the lost to history example, I'll give you two of them. So one of them with Rush, we found the alternate covers for moving pictures. So the ones that were not used, they didn't know they had it. And how would they know? It was in a, you know, an envelope in a mismarked box on the bottom shelf in a storage area, but we found it. And then what we did in this case, and this happens a lot for a lot of these big clients, is we took those, we created these spectacular lithographs. We had Getty and Alex sign them along with Deborah Samuel, who's the photographer. And we created a limited number of versions of those. They sold out really in a matter of a couple of hours because this was very special. There was a story attached to it. It was very scarce. And all the money went to charity, right? So that's something that like everybody sort of wins in that, and it comes from the discovery process. Another example on the audio side is with Def Leppard, and we were sort of digging through tapes and things that we found in Phil's house. And, you know, it was like, nobody really knew what these were. We got them digitized, you know, several of them, sent them to Joe and Phil. And Joe said, this is the lost song from Hysteria. He's like, I didn't know anybody had it. It was
that's why. Very good. Brad, have you had to look, every business has to evolve, but like, you know, nowadays it's like, if you were to look through old files of my band, okay, it would be like old stuff on Pro Tools, you know, and old stuff. So like, is the new archival, or let me put it this way, is the new archaeological dig that you go on more digital in nature, or is it that your artists are generally older? Or because, like, I gotta be honest, like sometimes I go on Dropbox and I'm like, oh my god, I forgot we did that tune like 8 years ago, you know. And then of course I listen, I'm like, well, now I know why, because it stinks. But you know, has your business evolved in the sense that you've had to become more technologically expansive to go on that archaeological dig in a different way?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So so the answer is sort of yes and sort of no. And the reason for that is that we have clients that span the you know, relatively young artists, and then ones that are, you know, truly legacy artists in the States and things like that. So obviously the longer the client has been around, the more different kinds of media that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
But most clients, even, you know, the older legacy artists, so much of the stuff is digital and has been digital, where we have had to kind of evolve a little bit, or maybe just sort of expand how we look at things, is that, and we see this quite a lot, is on the digital side, you know, one database was done one way, another database was done another way, things are stored in Dropbox or iPhoto or, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter, and trying to pull all these things together so that they align. And then, are there duplicates, which there usually are, and all that? And is the naming convention correct? Like, it is a real art and science process, which, you know, and obviously on the digital side, and you know this for sure, is that, you know, you can be dealing with terabytes of information, you know, that have to be dealt with. And even though in the audio side, you know, we've dealt with, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of tapes, at least with a tape, you kind of go, okay, this is the one tape, and then you kind of go from there.
And final question for me, Ryan, sorry, but this is such a fascinating different thing that it's just like I'm really like just fascinated by this. And is it, do you find that your clients are motivated by sort of like a desire to like amalgamate the body, the totality of the body of their work for the purposes of nostalgia and memory and sort of like psychic income, as opposed to saying, no, Brad, we want to do this because if we amalgamate all this stuff and put it all together, there's actually an economic reason we want to do this? Or is it yes and yes and all of the above?
Yeah, it's yes and yes, right? I think the you know, one of the things that we say kind of to our clients is, look, once you know what you have, then you can figure out what you want to do with it, right? Mm-hmm. And again, everybody's different. Some really just care about preservation and keeping things stored and secured for their children or grandchildren, and they really don't want to think about it. But for most, it really is about sort of these other areas. But the most, I think, overarching theme that we see is clients who, as this discovery process happens, the opportunity to share that with fans in a way that really they've never been able to do before. Which connects, you know, on, you know, again, not to get overly, you know, deep with this, but that's what connects on an emotional level, right? So I think that, and we're all fans, right? You guys are all fans of something, you know, music or otherwise. So all of a sudden, that discovery process for you as a fan that's shared from the artist directly to you, it benefits you as the fan, and it benefits them because now you are more connected. And I think what we also see is from when we share a lot of these things, obviously everything we do is on behalf of our clients, with fans, things that they hadn't heard before, and you have younger fans who are just discovering that artist, right? And we all know this, we've all gone through this, you know, phase in our lives. And then the opportunity for that fan to discover all of these other things, well, now you're cultivating a fan for life.
Not cool. Yeah, I didn't think of that. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Brad, most of the folks who watch or listen to this program who are artists tend to be in the earlier stages of their careers, right? We're talking about a lot of independent creators, folks that are either new to the industry or have been working in the industry, but, you know, don't work with a major label or not fully established and wealthy yet. But if they've started that journey, that would also mean that they have started already producing the things that might be the things that they want to preserve when they're older. And so for those artists out there who are starting to create things, that who are starting to do things today that could be their artifacts tomorrow, do you have any advice for those artists on how they can preserve and record the stuff that they're doing now so that when somebody like you comes along for them later, your job of digging up that information and those documents and those items becomes easier?
Yeah. So another really good question, right? So, I think I have a few answers for that. So number one, everything matters, right? And I think a lot of times people don't think, I'd be like, oh, I don't need this pass, I don't need this ticket, I don't, you know, or whatever it is that they might have physically, you know, or you know, in that case, but digitally, obviously otherwise, but it does, right? It all has value because there's some story that can be attached. This was the first show I did at whatever, right? So those types
of things. And also, you never know what's going to be valuable later.
You don't know. And I think the, you know, some of the most important things is that, and this is really difficult because artists go through different managers, they go through different business managers, they go through all sorts of different things, is that if you can lock into a system that works for you as an artist that you understand and can follow that system, or at least be able to maintain that knowledge to be like, oh yeah, this is why I did this way. If there's consistency to it, that will make your life a million times easier, because the biggest things are, and I wish I was sort of making up this example, but we saw one database where, you know, somebody referred to a color of something as yellow, and then another database with the same image and they refer to the color as banana. And it's like,
that sounds like something I would do.
It's just like, it's a disaster. So it's really put a system in place, save everything, and just, you know, make sure that things are consistent. But I think the other thing that's important just to note is that the things that are, that younger artists or that are starting to do this or kind of on their upswing, they all have fans, and fan behavior is really consistent. And this isn't a question of like, well, you should do this because 5 years or 10 years or 20 years from now, this is going to be important. It's important now. Fans care about this now. They care about your origin story. They care about seeing these things. How did you write this song? So it's not like, oh, we got to preserve this because someday we'll be a legacy artist, so we'll have to do something with it. Do it now. You know, there's value there.
How do you strike the right balance for these artists for preserving things so that you have them without just completely filling your living space with just boxes and boxes of things? I'm running into this right now as a new dad, right? Like every little thing my kid does, from like the, you know, the first time he spits up on a towel, or, you know, everything's a milestone, right? And if I were to keep every single thing, my house would just be filled to the top with stuff, which it is at the moment, because I don't know how to pick and choose the stuff that I think is going to matter. How do artists strike that balance? How, because you can't keep everything. So, I mean, what do you tell them when they say, like, what triage do I do to find the stuff that is actually going to be valuable later?
Well, I mean, that's almost a little bit of an impossible question to answer, because there's no way to know exactly what, you know, if this is going to be valuable versus not. I think the filter is, I think always, is there an interesting story with this? Okay. So, you know, if it's your Walgreens receipt, okay, I mean, that may not be interesting unless it's like, well, this is from when we had to buy this because, you know, the back of my guitar broke and I needed tape to go, like, or whatever, for us to finish recording, right? So, and it's difficult to try to do that with everything, obviously, but I think having that, you know, is this meaningful as part of the creative process? I think that's a good filter. And the rest of it is, you know, it's funny when you say like the boxes and boxes and boxes, like, you know, we have clients that have 10,000 square foot warehouses of things. They have saved everything. They have saved their Walgreens receipts just because that's how they're wired. So, you know, I think the, you know, it's always difficult to try to say what, I mean, even just using the words, what should you throw out? Like our archival team would like lose their mind, because the answer is like, you really shouldn't throw out anything.
Nothing.
But your question with it. And it's like, you know, if you can go through it is it with, there's a meaningful story about us or our evolution as a band, or, you know, the creative process, or, you know, things like that. That's those, you'd always say those are absolutely valuable. And then from there, you can probably have tiers that cut down from there.
I love that. I love the idea of the dividing line being, is there a good story here? I think that's a nice guiding principle to go with. Our guest has been Brad Mindich, the CEO of Definitive Authentic, an organization that is dedicated to preserving and protecting the legacies of iconic entertainers, athletes, and creators. Brad, this has been awesome. I mean, I know I speak for Gideon when I say this is one of the most interesting interviews we've done. I thought that I have had conversations with people who've done literally everything in the entertainment industry. You're the first person I've spoken with, and I think Gideon, that's is also the case as well, who does precisely what you do and gosh, does it seem interesting. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. One more question before we let you go, Brad.
Please, sure.
Do you have any last tips for the indie creators out there to help them move their careers forward?
Oh, my. Just in general or?
Oh, yeah. You know, just parting thought, just wanting to capitalize on your, you know, experience and expertise. You know, you've held so many roles in the entertainment industry. And, you know, I just want to give you a chance to give us one last piece of parting advice.
Yeah. So thank you for having me on. It's really a pleasure to talk to you guys. I'm grateful for you, you know, making the time to speak with me. So I did grow up in the radio business, right? The you know, newspaper and radio business. And obviously radio is quite different from when I was in it. But I mean, one of the things that resonated over and over again in my family's, you know, flagship radio station was the first alternative radio station in the country. So we broke all sorts of new bands. And there's a very big difference between good and great. And lots of good, there's tons of good out there, but great is what really sort of cuts through. So for, you know, these indie creators who, you know, are working at this every day, like, focus on great, because great is what will get you there.
Love that. Our thanks to Brad Mindich, thanks to Gideon King and producer Lauren, and thanks to all of you viewers and listeners for checking out Break the Business. It has been a blast, and we'll see you next week.